21. Roger that. I said the word film with ostentatious relish when I spoke with friends, drawing out those M's. I was simultaneously mocking the lofty cahier du cinéma approach that aesthetes take to the cinematic arts and acknowledging that filmmaking had become a kind of religion for me. Film was my mantra. Come hell or high water, I was going to make movies. But how? It was no easy goal to achieve, even for someone with a track record in the business and a hit TV show. Actors are often thought to be striving above their station when they display an ambition to be filmmakers. It's a long-running industry joke, the pretentious, delusional kid who says, "What I really want to do is direct." From a distance, or a quick scan of my IMDb page, it seems like it was a foregone conclusion that I would transition effortlessly from acting in sitcoms to directing major films for the big studios. In reality, it was an arduous grind that required hustle, determination, and luck. I carried a lot of worry with me in my happy days years. Did I stand a chance of having a fulfilling adult career? Would I ever be taken seriously enough for someone to give me a chance? Dad and I had written a screenplay together called "Tis the Season." I really wanted it to be my first feature as a director. The script was based on the experiences of a USC friend of mine. He was a troubled guy from Columbus, Ohio, who had a difficult family life back home and wanted to stay in LA for Christmas break. He somehow scratched together a few bucks and rented a flea pit apartment in the seediest, druggiest part of Hollywood, the same Western Avenue area where my friend Doug and I had edited The Initiation. This inspired me to write a coming-of-age story about a young man who, while living amid Hollywood's dens of iniquity, falls for a prostitute. It was a very slice-of-life, Tom Waits-like exploration of that Skid Row milieu, with the characters humanized rather than flattened into two dimensions. Dad had the idea to give the prostitute a protective older brother who happened to be gay, which made the script both more nuanced and more provocative. You rarely saw gay characters in mainstream films in the mid-1970s. I was convinced that "Tis the Season" would be a great movie if only I could make it. So I tapped my inner entrepreneur. A short time after our wedding, Cheryl and I flew down to Sydney for a Happy Days promotional trip. Strangely enough, Australia was the first country where the show took off in dominant fashion. In the U.S., we attracted the teen audience early on, but it really wasn't until the third and fourth seasons that Happy Days became the ratings juggernaut and cultural phenomenon that people remember it as. In Australia, we were an instant smash. Our benefactor in that country was Reg Grundy, a media baron who had made his fortune inventing and producing TV programs. Grundy was a hardy, gregarious man with a white grandpa mustache, a shorter Australian version of Ted Turner. He hosted Cheryl and me on his speedboat and seemed to take authentic interest when I spoke of my directing ambitions. He loved Happy Days for the record-breaking ratings it received down under, but he was even more effusive in describing Australia's burgeoning homegrown film and television industry. I thought that perhaps I stood a chance of becoming a part of it. So I pitched "Tis the Season" to Grundy with the idea that I would direct it. I planned to cast Charlie Martin Smith in the lead and hoped to cast Candy Clark or Terry Garr opposite him. Grundy liked what he heard. We reached a verbal agreement that if I could secure distribution for my film in the United States, he would kick in $150,000 for the world rights outside of the United States. Finding a U.S. backer distributor would be a tall order, especially for a 21-year-old novice director, still best known for being Opie. But my talk with Reg was a promising start. The third season of Happy Days proved Fred Silverman right. the three-camera format, the studio audience, and the more pronounced emphasis on Fonzie made the show bigger than ever. Lowell Ganz and Mark Rothman wrote a sharp script for the season opener, Fonzie Moves In, which set up the circumstances for the Fonz to become the Cunninghams' tenant, living in a little apartment above their garage. Now it was plausible for him to be in our house all the time, not just at Arnold's, our local hangout. Happy Days did indeed knock out JJ and Good Times. We beat them in our shared time slot that season, finishing 11th in the ratings. They slid to number 24. The following season, CBS moved Good Times to Wednesdays, and Happy Days became the top-rated show on television. We entered our imperial phase, ranking in the top five for three seasons in a row. In the mid-1970s, Henry was not merely a TV star, but one of the biggest stars in the world, period. In 1976, his Annus Mirabilis, he, his ducktail hairstyle, and his iconic black leather jacket were all over the newsstand. Henry's face was on the cover of People, the music magazine Crawdaddy, the kids' magazines Dynamite and Bananas, the teen magazine Young Miss, and even Mad, where the famous illustrator Jack Ricard drew him wearing a false nose, mustache, and glasses. TV Guide paired Henry with me for one of its covers that year, both of us dressed in character as we flanked a hot rod. There was no doubt that the Fonz was good for all of us on Happy Days. It was like being on a baseball team with a slugging young superstar batting cleanup. Why wouldn't you want your manager to play him every day? Especially if this slugger was a considerate, collaborative man who was impossible not to love. Marion, Tom, Anson, Donnie, Aaron Moran, me, none of us begrudged Henry for becoming so popular or the show's creatives for running with what worked. I was particularly impressed by Lowell Ganz, a tall, rail-thin guy who had a facility for writing fun, playful scenes for Henry and me. Lowell made me laugh off-camera, too. He told me he came from an area of Queens that he pronounced more Jewish than Tel Aviv. We became good friends and eventually creative partners. Lowell co-wrote four of my first seven features, Night Shift, Splash, Gung Ho, and Parenthood. But sometimes the changes to the show made me feel a little out of my depth. The Andy Griffith Show was built on heart and gentle, idiosyncratic humor. That was where my skills and taste lay. Apart from a few set pieces for Don Knotts or Howard Morris, we seldom went for hard laughs. The first two seasons of Happy Days were like that, too. The new format, by contrast, was predicated on getting hard laughs, framing up jokes, setting them up beat by beat, and building to an explosion. Playing to that live studio audience, going for the comedy throat. Gary Marshall expanded the writing staff to include sharper, hipper minds from the 70s comedy scene, some of whom were working as stand-ups. Jerry Paris, our director, was absolutely in his element. He had made his name directing The Dick Van Dyke Show, one of the first sitcoms to have a live studio audience. Jerry was a tall, manic man who always wore a bright red V-neck sweater on shooting days and kept a motor-mouth Don Rickles-style patter going at all times. When I expressed worry about nailing a comedy beat, he grabbed me by the face and said, "Look at this cute little punim. How can someone with a punim like this act so neurotic and Jewish? We should just bar mitzvah you and get it over with." Jerry was a master at comedic staging and energizing a scene, and he loved the dynamic between Henry and me. He said that I reminded him of Dick Van Dyke, a conventionally attractive goy who was expert at playing off funny Jewish guys like Carl Reiner and Maury Amsterdam. Henry, Anson, Tom Bosley, and Donnie are Jewish. That comparison is monumentally unfair to Dick, a comic genius in his own right. But it shows how much the creative side of Happy Days, people like Jerry, Gary, and Lowell appreciated me and what I had to offer. Our set was loose and playful. On rehearsal days, we often broke out in tape ball fights, which are the same thing as snowball fights, only with balls made of wadded-up gaffer tape. We liked to gang up on Jerry Paris, an avid gambler, as he placed bets on the set's payphone, literally taping him to the phone stand as he barked to his bookie, "Put $200 on the Rams!" This camaraderie carried over into our private lives. We consulted with each other on buying our first homes. We attended each other's weddings. We toasted the births of our respective firstborns. Happy Days was a happy place. It was the network side that continually disappointed me. Just ahead of our Christmas break that third season, the cast was hanging around on Stage 19 at Paramount, comparing notes on the holiday gifts that we had received from corporate. "Hey, Howard, I got a wallet," said Anson. "How about you?" I opened my gift. I, too, had received a wallet. Tom Bosley and Marion Ross opened their gifts. Wallets. Pretty soon we realized that we had all received the same wallet. It was a quality wallet, fine-grained leather, nice and smooth, no complaints. Then Henry spoke up. He had not been given a wallet. With some sheepishness, he disclosed to us that he had been given a VCR. In 1975, a VCR was a new toy, hard to get and very expensive, worth about $5,000 in today's dollars. Henry's state-of-the-art, U-matic 3/4-inch video cassette recorder cost exponentially more than our wallets. The disparity was outrageous. None of us was in desperate need of a VCR, or a new wallet, for that matter. But the thoughtlessness with which management singled out one person and rendered the rest of us second class was galling. We were all displeased. Henry was a little embarrassed. That's when I became shop steward Howard, designated by the cast to be the point man in making our feelings known. No one wanted Henry to forfeit his VCR, but we wanted to hold management accountable. Using the payphone on the set, I called ABC Corporate, demanding to speak to whoever was in charge of talent relations. A young executive named Bob Boyette came to the phone. I gave him the third degree. "This is about our Christmas gifts, Bob," I said. "I feel a little uncomfortable even complaining about them, but it's about fairness. Here's the thing. All of us are happy for Henry's success. It's fantastic for the show. We all love him. But on the stage, we are an ensemble. That's what Gary preaches. And that gets undermined when you give Henry a VCR and the rest of us a wallet. So I'd like ABC to think about what they've done. And by the way, I'm sending my wallet back." "You don't have to do that," said Bob in measured, friendly tones. "I didn't know that your Christmas gifts mattered so much." "Yeah, well, they shouldn't, but they do," I said, now with a full head of steam. "So with all due respect, I am returning mine." Poor Bob was not culpable in all this. He was a sweetheart who went on to become a successful TV producer in the 80s, creating such shows as Bosom Buddies and Full House in partnership with Tom Miller. He just happened to be the person stuck with taking my call and absorbing my tirade. The network higher-ups, though, were another story, and this would not be the last time that they brought me low. I really did mail my wallet back. I'm pretty sure I was the only member of the cast to do so. Henry still has his VCR. I obligingly did tons of interviews for Happy Days, but I couldn't get through a single one of them without a reporter asking me some version of the question, "So how does it feel that Fonzie has taken over your show?" As much as I tried not to let this get to me, sometimes it did. The eczema on my eyelids flared up. Some mornings I awoke in a funk. Driving in my camper to Paramount, I'd sometimes feel my throat tightening with anxiety and fantasize about playing hooky. I noted the freeway signs indicating San Diego to the south. Tijuana is just over the border. What if I just keep going, and I don't stop until I get there? I wasn't tempted by debauchery so much as disappearance. Gary Marshall was astute in recognizing that he needed to take action to keep us all feeling like an ensemble. His masterstroke was to establish a Happy Days softball team. We started out casually, playing Sunday games in the Valley against the talent agencies and the casts and crews of other TV shows. Even some of the movies that were filming on the Paramount lot got involved. One of our early opponents was the Marathon Man team, whose lineup included Dustin Hoffman and William Devane, though not, unfortunately, Sir Laurence Olivier. Gradually, our softball exploits commanded bigger and bigger stages. We did promotional tours of Major League Baseball stadiums, including Wrigley Field, Shea Stadium, Dodger Stadium, Candlestick Park, and Milwaukee County Stadium. Our opponents were usually teams of local celebrities and former pro athletes. Making us travel as a team was such a brilliant idea on Gary's part because we developed real camaraderie on the road and bonded over something that had nothing to do with the show. Donnie was speedy and a good athlete, so he became our center fielder. I played in left. Anson could play any infield spot. Second base was a rotating position, sometimes Tom Bosley, other times Aaron Moran or Marion Ross. Gary, Jerry, and a few of the writers played. Even big Al Molinaro got his uniform dirty. Henry had not grown up playing team sports, though he was a good water skier, as Happy Days fans would come to know in a soon-to-be-infamous episode, but we couldn't play softball without him. That's where our secret weapon came in. My brother, Clint.
Ron gave Henry the first baseball glove he had ever owned. Henry had obviously never played the sport, but he was a gamer who didn't want to let his mates down. I was in my heyday as a ball player, pitching for the Burroughs High School team, so I did my level best to turn Henry into the Happy Days team's starting pitcher. Stage 19 at Paramount, where Happy Days was shot, had a large, long, open stretch of space between the audience bleachers and the sets. It was where the cameras operated on shooting days, but on non-shooting days, this space made for an ideal bullpen. So that's where I held my lessons with Henry, directly in front of the interiors for Arnold's, and the Cunningham family's living room. The roster that Gary assembled from the crew had several ringers, and we all worked to mold the Fonz into a capable hurler. Henry was an eager, humble student who happily gave himself over to coaching. What I taught him was actually a modified fast-pitch throwing motion, with no high arc or windmilling. I recognized that his natural arm action made the ball move, and, just like Greg Maddux, he could really hit his spots. His best pitch floated up and inside, tying righties up in knots. Gary Marshall was so pleased with the work I had done with Henry that he invited me to join the Happy Days team as its catcher. When we played in front of stadium crowds, the throng wanted to see the Fonz make hitters look foolish, and I knew how to oblige. I set up inside and got the majority of overstriding hitters to meekly pop up. Calling for an outside pitch was risky, both in the game and for the show. With the ball over the plate, someone might hammer it up the middle and smack Henry square in the chompers. The poor guy was a great actor, but he couldn't field a lick. Henry was open about his limitations. If there was a comebacker, he'd turn his body sideways to absorb the blow, trading a potential bloody lip for a body bruise. If there was an infield pop-up, he'd scurry off the mound and left the put-out to the Happy Days staff writer Fred Fox or the dialogue coach Walter Von Huene, who were two of our better defensive infielders. In the beginning, we played the Hollywood equivalent of intramural ball, squaring off on Sundays against other teams assembled from L.A. show business folk. I was in awe when we went up against a squad that included a beer-drinking left fielder named Alice Cooper. He couldn't hit Henry either. The softball league satisfied my yen for competition and success at a time when acting didn't. And traveling first class to play in Major League stadiums wasn't so bad. I'll never forget seeing my name up on the scoreboard at Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia in front of 50,000 fans as I stepped to the plate. An unbelievable feeling. The whole experience gave me a sense of purpose I might have otherwise lacked. I was never going to be good enough to become a professional ball player, but coaching and playing like this scratched an itch. Still, I loved acting. I was proud to have made it as far as I had. Most of the kids with whom I'd come up, going on casting calls for westerns and cop shows in the 60s, had already fallen away and returned to civilian life. Maybe it was now my turn to fall away. I didn't know. But I wasn't going to let that happen without a fight. I was haunted by the same question as Ron. Did I stand a chance of having a fulfilling adult career in show business? As scarce as good parts had become for me, I never stopped going out on auditions. But the process sometimes worked my nerves. In 1975, I joined every other young guy in town in reading for an ambitious new space opera called Star Wars, the brainchild of Ron's American Graffiti director, George Lucas. In those days, before casting directors could simply watch an actor on videotape, or digitally, they called in pretty much every dude in the teens to 20s age range to test for the part of Luke Skywalker. I already knew that I didn't stand a chance. Luke was written as this dashing young hero, and at age 16, I was already starting to lose my hair. But shit, I was a working actor. You don't not go to an audition when you're called. Star Wars casting was held on the Fox lot in Century City. I showed up and milled around outdoors with a couple of dozen other young guys who were waiting to be called in. One of them, standing right behind me, was a dude named Mark Hamill. Then I heard my name. Go time. Auditions get my juices flowing. They're a form of competition, and I approach them confidently, determined to be the last man standing. But Star Wars was different. Not because of its genre or sweep, but its timing. Luke Skywalker was a romantic male lead, most definitely an adult role, of a kind I had never played in my short life. My palms were sweaty when I entered the audition room, an office. My nervousness skyrocketed when I saw that George Lucas wasn't the only person for whom I would be auditioning. Francis Ford Coppola, who I held in the highest esteem, sat there, smiling at me. He was helping George cast Star Wars, as was Gene O'Havens assisting George as he had done during the casting of American Graffiti. But no sign of George. Weird. Francis and Gino flanked an imposing mahogany desk. Behind it was a big leather swivel chair, its back to me, obscuring its occupant. Abruptly, the chair swung around, and there was George. He took a beat to give me the once-over. Then he said with a flourish, "Commander Baylock, the Corbomite maneuver." It totally threw me. Here I was, a young actor trying to get an adult part, and there he was, making a reference to something I did as a 7-year-old. America was only in the earliest days of the Star Trek revival, when reruns of the show were not yet widely in syndication, and Trekkies were only beginning to be a thing. So I should have been flattered that George was familiar with what was then just another job on my resume. But because I was in a slump and entering my angry young man phase, what I thought in my head was, get a fucking life, George. I stumbled through the audition. I knew in the moment I didn't stand a chance, reading the way I read and looking the way I did. I did not receive a callback. Still, I learned something. George's friendly overture represented the beginning of a phenomenon that follows me to this day, being admired for work I did as a kid. But I just wasn't ready at 16 to appreciate that. It seemed less like recognition and more like belittlement. It had the same ring as, "Hey, where's your bear?" I guess I had some growing up to do.
I wasn't exactly landing choice movie roles either. One day, during the third season of Happy Days, I was sitting in the Paramount commissary reading a script over lunch. My agent had sent it to me. I thought it was terrible. A broad, zany car chase comedy with weak jokes and cardboard characters. Its title, which will tell you everything about my reflexive revulsion, was Eat My Dust. It was depressing. This was the level of film projects that were coming my way. But Eat My Dust had one thing to recommend it. It was a Roger Corman production. Corman was known as the King of the Bees, a prolific director and producer of cheaply made movies that went straight to drive-ins and regional theaters via his distribution company, New World Pictures. He had famously shot the original 1960 version of The Little Shop of Horrors in only 2 days, helping to launch the career of one of its stars, Jack Nicholson. He had adapted several of Edgar Allan Poe's stories into campy horror films, one of which, The Pit and the Pendulum, was a childhood obsession of mine, thanks to its repeated airings on Million Dollar Movie. Roger had a reputation in Hollywood. Well, several reputations. He was a shrewd, fiercely intelligent businessman who had come up with an efficient, assembly line approach to production that turned a tidy profit. He was also an emotionally mercurial man who was charming when in a good mood and best avoided when grumpy. And he was notorious for his wildly eclectic taste, pumping out exploitation flicks, but also serving as the U.S. distributor for such European art house directors as Federico Fellini, Ingmar Bergman, and François Truffaut. Most pertinent to my interests, Roger had an awesome track record for nurturing young filmmakers. Among those who had served apprenticeships under him were Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, Peter Bogdanovich, and Jonathan Demme. I yearned for a shot to join their ranks. Plus, Roger's distribution company could potentially secure my agreement with Reg Grundy for Tis the Season, which was contingent on my lining up a distributor in the States. So rather than toss the script for Eat My Dust in the garbage, I called my agent, Bill Schuler, and told him that I wanted to meet with Mr. Corman. This pleased Bill because the offer was a firm one. For good money, $75,000 for a 4-week shoot, Corman's top rate. He generally used no-name actors, so by his standards, I was a good get. On the day of the appointment, as I stood outside the building on the Sunset Strip where Corman kept his office, I was surprised to see Bill show up. He had been my agent since my childhood, a dashing man with a pencil mustache who now appeared small and diminished. "I'm coming in with you," he said. "No, Bill, I really want to do this alone," I said. His face fell. I can't blame him. Imagine having some 21-year-old client basically tell you on the sidewalk, "Get the hell out of here, go home." I knew the play I was going to make, and I feared that Bill would have been freaked out by my plans to go off script and negotiate with Corman. Had he been present, he might have interrupted me and undercut my strategy. Roger is a tall man of surprisingly patrician bearing. We shook hands, and I very quickly got down to business. "I'm well aware of what you've done for young filmmakers, and also for the films you've made. I loved The Pit and the Pendulum," I said, going on to heap praise on more of his movies. Boxcar Bertha with Scorsese, Targets with Bogdanovich, Dementia 13 with Coppola. Then, in the most grown-up voice I could muster, I said, "As for Eat My Dust, I didn't care for it very much. It's not the kind of work that I'm looking to do as an actor. But I have a script. It's called 'Tis the Season, and I believe I have half the money for it out of Australia. If you'll read my script, put up the other half, and distribute my film, I'll do Eat My Dust." Roger arched his eyebrows. "You're a filmmaker?" he said. "I've just made some short films, and I used to go to film school at USC," I said. "But I'm also on Happy Days," and he cut me off. "I'll read the script," he said, "and send over any film work of your own that you can show me." We shook hands again, and as I was leaving, Roger said, "You know, I like to think that I turn out directors for Hollywood the way USC turns out running backs for the NFL. I'd very much like to be one of those running backs," I said. A few days later, Roger called me. "You and your father have written a very good script," he said, "but it's a character piece, an art house film. That's not the kind of film that I make. But look, I watched your shorts, and I can see that you can direct. So I have a counterproposal for you." On paper, what Roger suggested looked like one of those comically lopsided trades in baseball, with him, the savvy GM, and me, the sucker. There were a ridiculous number of hoops for me to jump through. If and only if I agreed to be in Eat My Dust, Roger would pay me a whopping $2,500 to write an outline for a new film. I could write it by myself, with Dad, however I wanted. I just couldn't resubmit 'Tis the Season or anything like it. Then, if Roger liked the outline, I could turn it into a screenplay for $12,500. Then, if Roger liked the screenplay, I could direct the movie, but only if I also starred in it. And here was the kicker. Failing all that, if he didn't greenlight a feature for me to make, the consolation prize was that he would assign me to direct the second unit on one of the many low-budget action flicks he churned out each year. This was hardly a situation where some beneficent financier was saying, "Yes, I shall back your movie, and it shall premiere at next year's Cannes Film Festival." But it was as close as I was going to get to a real chance.